Live streaming is on.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our webinar, the land-based RAS boom in the balance. And this is an Undercurrent News webinar, and I'm Matt Craes. I'm delighted to host this webinar at a very interesting time in the land-based aquaculture industry, and an exciting time in its development. And I'd just like to very briefly mention a thank you to our sponsors and recognition to our sponsors who helped to make these events possible. And we have Panaferd AX, Exeter Clean, Innovasea, and Skretting. So a big thank you to them. And I'd just like to briefly introduce the panelists today. And I'll just give a little bit of a sense of where we'll take this webinar. There'll be a very brief presentation from me just to set up the topic, and also because with Undercurrent News, we are about to publish a report with some numbers. And then we'll get into questions with the panelists. And I would encourage everybody listening to post questions, because the last half an hour of this webinar will be dedicated to Q&A from the outside audience. So starting with Maggie, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Matt, and thanks for inviting me to join today. I'm Maggie Fried. I am the head of the Ocean Seafood and Aquaculture Investor Consortium at Creo Syndicate. And just to give a brief background on that, Creo Syndicate is a nonprofit organization that is a network of investors, primarily single family offices, who are investing in areas related to combating climate change and promoting sustainability. I work with a dedicated subgroup of those investors who are all either actively investing in or have committed to investing in sustainable oceans, aquaculture, and seafood. And collectively, this group has a goal of deploying $250 million into these sectors by 2023. And one of the ways that I work with them is through sourcing and doing initial evaluation of deal flow, including land-based aquaculture.
That's great. Thank you, Maggie. And I look forward to asking you about that as we get into the webinar.
Absolutely.
Eric Tveteras, if you could introduce yourself, please.
Sure. Hi. Thanks, Matt. And thanks for inviting me as well. So I'm Eric Tveteras, investment director in New Nutreco, which is the corporate venturing arm of Nutreco, the global feed company. I together with the team focus most of our time on land-based farming, but contrary to popular belief, we also look into other approaches such as offshore and closed containment in the sea systems. We've made five investments so far in land-based salmon farming companies and approaching just north of 50 million euros invested to date.
That's great. Thank you, Eric. And lastly, Carl Oystein Oyehaug. If you could present yourself, please.
Sure. First of all, thanks for the invitation to attend here today. My name is Carl Oystein Oyehaug, and I'm the Chief Financing Officer of Atlantic Sapphire. Atlantic Sapphire is the world's largest land-based salmon farmer, founded back in 2010, with our main operation here in South Florida, where we currently are in full operation with our 10,000 metric ton blue house here, while also being in construction of our phase two expansion, which will bring total capacity to 25,000 tons of salmon volumes per year. So very excited to be here and to discuss the important topic of the future of land-based.
That's great. So I'm going to bore you for a few minutes with that presentation, but it's very brief, and it'll have some numbers, and it will sort of tee up the conversation, and we'll get into questions. So I'm going to share my screen. Okay, and I'm going to go into presenting mode. Right. Okay, so the land-based RAS boom in the balance. So here's the commercial. Last year, we published a report on salmon exclusively in August 2020, and we compiled data for the first time on projects around the world. And both Spheric, which is my company, and Undercurrent News are, as a collaboration, publishing a report very shortly in the coming weeks on all species. So here's the results that we came up with. We found 197 facilities around the world. This is both operational and future. And these are, how did we count this number? We've been looking at this space since about 2017, and just basically firsthand information, market intelligence, industry reports, and we've just been, you know, tracking this space quite closely. And for the first time, we've included other species. It's quite one of the, I guess, one of the surprises when we compiled this year's report and we looked at other species for the first time, was the fact that most of the future projects are in salmon. And in actual fact, when it comes to other species, there are a number of facilities that are in operation, but we found very few projects under development. And we looked at the shrimp space for the first time, and we found quite a number of projects around the world. Again, this puts it a little bit into a different perspective, but you can see that the two big aquaculture species that are the high value species that are sold into Europe and North America especially, those are really dominating this data. But there are other species that are up and coming as well. So this is not that surprising for anybody who looked at last year's report. Norway, in actual fact, has many projects as well as the US. I guess the trend here is that most of these projects are being developed in high population, wealthier countries, and close to urban centers of consumption. But as well, we do see some projects in countries that produce, that are aquaculture producers. So there's been a big push in Norway to get licenses to develop land-based facilities. This year, we were able to look at the salmon space for the first time. And I have to point out a mistake that we have in our data with the operative facilities. It's meant to be 32 rising to 34. But we've counted 25 new projects since our August 2020 publication. We also took away three projects that have gone dormant, where there's no noticeable sign of funding or any type of traction. Shrimp seems to be a very exciting space. I spoke to our panelists on our preparatory calls, and Eric was telling me about the shrimp space as well. Now, in our count, we found 16 projects from homegrown shrimp. This is the company owned by CP Foods, a subsidiary that's starting up one facility in the US, but it's looking to build a franchising model. So that it actually counts for a lot of those projects. We found 12 operating projects, but many of these are at a pilot stage. So, you know, not much production now versus actual installed capacity. And that's a story we see repeated in all other species, where the big ask is, you know, do these projects get to the nameplate densities? And then again, once again, we found some projects for other species. And one of the questions I've been asking people in the industry is, you know, is RAS exclusively for high value species? Because that's what seems to be the case. And in actual fact, it's quite interesting. One of the comments from somebody at Aquamouth that I spoke to said that even low value species can be an interesting prospect for RAS, because they're quite robust, catfish, for example, and they can thrive at higher densities. So thanks for listening to that. The report is available soon, and it's also, besides the data, there's a lot of insights that we get from conversations with executives in this industry, and we have profiles for all of the projects. Thanks for listening to that. And now we'll get to the part that everybody wants, which is the...
I think Matt closed his browser again by mistake, so he'll be with us in a few seconds, I hope.
Okay. I've got, every time I stop that presentation, I get kicked out of the webinar. That's fine. Okay. After that, let's get to questions. So can everybody hear me okay? I just want to make sure that I'm fully restored. Okay, good. So Maggie, I was particularly keen to get your perspective on this sector, especially. To date, what we've seen in the last few months, we've seen a lot of companies get financed in Scandinavia and the Oslo Stock Exchange. And that's been the main mechanism that a lot of these projects have been using to get project financing. Do you think that your constituency, North America, family offices, are interested in this space? And how do they perceive the risks inherent in land-based farming, aquafarming rather?
Yeah, so just a small correction, which is that CREO members are not just in North America, but are actually global, though we do have a large number of members in the Americas and Europe. So this represents thoughts from across those geographies. But what I will say is that when I started in this role 18 months ago, there was significant interest in land-based aquaculture. Whenever I would connect with these investors, it seemed like a topic that was top of mind. So much so that I pulled together a group discussion of our members so that they could share with one another what they were seeing in the sector, both their interests as well as their concerns. And over this time, I have seen a number of land-based opportunities, which I've shared out, and they've gotten various levels of traction from among our membership. But what I will say is over the past few months, it seems like there is less excitement around the space. Again, this is what I'm hearing from our membership. But on the other hand, I'm still sharing out the deals that I see and still getting some interest, though it does feel like perhaps that initial interest is not being taken into diligence as it was previously. So a few things on this, Matt, which you and I have discussed and you mentioned in the presentation, which is there seems to be growing interest in other species besides salmon. The larger salmon projects require a lot of capital, which either are beyond the means of many family offices, or if they were to participate, their ownership is so diluted that they can't have a meaningful impact in ownership of the company, if that's their strategy. And for many of them, it is. And so there's an interest in other species, other high value species. I've been seeing a lot of shrimp deals, as you mentioned. And so this seems to be gaining some interest and some traction. But broadly, there is still concern around many of the risks I'm sure we'll get into today. But in particular, looking at, again, really high CapEx costs, really high capital needs. And there's a strong desire to see the cost of production get lower and be closer to that of ocean-based production. And then the last thing I'll say on this is that I have seen a number of our members who might be interested in this space and want to be able to, in some ways, engage in it, capitalize on its success, and then take bets on it. But they're not doing it through investing in production. They're doing it through investing in ancillary technologies and companies that plan to partner with RAS companies, RAS production companies, but aren't actually doing the production themselves.
That's great. Thanks. Do you think there'll be any other mechanisms that in which they could invest in the live production assets? I mean, we've seen a lot of new investment trends recently, the whole SPAC kind of craze, I guess, has emerged. Are there instruments where it would become more appealing?
I think SPAC's an interesting one. And I think we would want to see revenue, significant revenue, before you're going to SPAC. And as your presentation just pointed out, there's a lot of companies that are in the earlier stages. And even companies that are already in production, their revenue is still limited. They're looking to scale. Again, there are a few who might be exceptions to that. So I don't know whether the logical route is to SPAC, but it does provide a significant amount of capital to companies. But I haven't seen from our membership an interest. There is a lot of interest broadly from Creo membership in SPACs, but not necessarily in the aquaculture space. With that being said, there might be other mechanisms, for example, project finance, which might diminish some of the risks than to someone who's just going in with equity. But I have to say, of the companies who pitched to me, I see pretty traditional financing structures.
Great, thank you. So Eric, I would like to bring the conversation to you. As Nutreco's invested, or Nutreco New Frontiers, which is the venture capital arm of the company, has invested in five companies. You've gone through the due diligence process. Nutreco has a long history with aquaculture and understands the space. How do you, and I guess, as Maggie said, this year there's been a lot of noise and speculation and some doubts starting to creep in. How does Nutreco, as a long-term investor, look at 2021 and where we are at right now?
Sure. So I think you mentioned a keyword right there, that we, as a long-term investor and a strategic investor in this space, we have a certain luxury of not being seeking a specific exit horizon or a certain financial return within a certain time frame. And that allows us to view the risk profile of land-based farming, whether salmon or shrimp or new species, in a different lens than I think other investor types would. So we've always viewed, for example, biological risk or operating risk as acceptable risk factors to us. We know there will be ups and downs and bumps in the road. And with traditional aquaculture, it will for sure not have a linear path going from pilot scale and through revenue generation without any hiccups. So having that luxury allows us to take that view. So for us, it's always been, and even more so now, just financing risk in general. For the companies that we pay particular attention to. So in the five companies that we diligenced, we took an exceptionally strong look at the financing strategy of the companies, which up until now, I guess it's fair to say, to a certain extent, has been reliant on, let's call it the Nordic capital markets model, pioneered by Atlantic Sapphire, and more so than we did in the past. There's only one company in our portfolio which was fully financed for phase one of its operations, which made that particular hurdle obviously a lot easier for us to overcome in that case.
Right. And I guess something I was keen to ask you was, you know, as outsiders, we see a lot of the data from the publicly traded companies in Oslo. And that's sort of, I guess, what the outside world sees. Yourselves, I think there's one or two actual operating facilities in your portfolio. How do you look at it? Because you look at different data to the rest of us. Do you see a growing stability in these production systems? How does that look from where you are?
Well, I'd say yes and no. As you pointed out, some of the companies in our portfolio are listed today, so there are obvious legal and regulatory barriers in terms of information that they can provide to us. So it's not the case that we are insiders and privy to any other information than the market. Having said that, we have taken an approach within our portfolio that we would like to learn and contribute with our learning and know-how to the extent that we can. For example, we have a requirement or have had a requirement for our investors investments to establish so-called technical advisory committees, which are advisory bodies only towards the board and or management, where we would like to have a role in that committee, and but not just for us, we also invite other stakeholders in the investor group and the technology provider and people from management itself to use that body as an organ for making the right decisions in, for example, detailed engineering or operations.
Right, perfect. And I'm sure we'll return to that topic in the outside Q&A. On that note, I just want to remind the audience to send us questions, because we will get to those shortly. And, you know, hopefully we'll have plenty of time to get through. I expect quite a few questions, but please send them through anyway. So finally, and sorry for making you wait, Carl, but as Atlantic Sapphire, I just to give a little bit of background here, I recently interviewed Johan Andreassen on our podcast, and so we weren't expecting to speak to you today, but a lot has happened recently with Atlantic Sapphire. The Q2 results came after the podcast, and the very unfortunate incident at the Denmark facility last week. And the reason I mention these things is because I think everybody is talking about Atlantic Sapphire right now, and we thought that it was, you know, it was best for you guys to join our webinar if you could. I guess the question to speak, there's always perception versus reality, right? Where is Atlantic Sapphire right now? And where would you say is the industry in terms of its developments?
Hmm. It's a good question. And I think from our point of view, if we look at what's happened over the last couple of years, there is no doubt that Atlantic Sapphire has had some challenges that we were not expecting when we started out. And I think it was already mentioned earlier in this this discussion that it is fair to expect that it will be somewhat of a bumpy road, but we do feel that we have had more bumps in the road than what we could expect it. And I think for us, the biggest topic over the last 2 years has been that we've had considerable construction-related issues. And this has had an effect on our ability to provide our fish with the right conditions, and therefore also to deliver on the volume side, which directly results in financial performance. So there is no doubt that it's been a tough start to the year, for example, for us. We've had breakdowns of everything from our chiller plant, equipment that was not delivered according to spec. And as a result, it's only in the last couple of months that we've had stable operating conditions throughout the farm, and where we finally can give the fish the conditions they need to thrive. So for us, for example, the initial batches, they haven't had those conditions that are necessary to really show the true potential of land-based salmon farming. But the positive is that now all of those ramp-up issues have been fixed. Risk is considerably lower in our day-to-day production. And the batches of salmon that were introduced from middle of 2020, those will raise the bar on what performance is going to be like. So we expect that when we start harvesting those batches in the middle of next year, you will really see what industry can aim for here and what unit economics really look like. And I think a very important point that was mentioned by Maggie is that, yes, these types of projects, they are very capital intensive. It does require a lot of capex to build the facilities. And the only way to make them profitable is to take advantage of economies of scale. You will not be able to build a small RAS salmon farm and make it work financially. That is simply not possible due to the very high fixed cost nature of this business. In order for this to succeed, and I think that Atlantic Sapphire has made this clear to many investors, in order to succeed, you need a certain set of attributes to the company. You need the right team. You need the right location with the right naturally given conditions, specifically water intake and discharge. You need to have the right construction partners, because this is not a small scale, smolt farm somewhere in Norway, which has been done 100 times before. This is large scale infrastructure that requires completely different skills. And last but not least, we've seen that having experience is so important. We've been doing this for 10 years. And even though we've been doing this for 10 years, we still stumble upon unexpected challenges. So in order for this to succeed, you need all of those factors. And I think that over the last year, especially, investors have become more and more educated on what to look for when evaluating projects. And we are quite confident that many of those 100 plus projects that you identified, Matt, in your research, most of those will never happen. And out of those that will be built, unfortunately, many of these will fail, because the reality is that farming salmon on land in RAS systems is not easy. And I think that it's positive for investors that the last couple of years, with the industry moving at a very fast pace, has made it possible for the investors to understand the risk factors better, so that we avoid investors investing in projects that maybe might not succeed at the end of the day.
Right. That's a good answer. Thank you. And I guess, you know, the speaking on behalf of the project developers, I think that you carry the entire weight of an industry on your shoulders. And people are just looking at Atlantic Sapphire and if it's going to work, when it's going to work. What type of, and the news flow, I think, totally dictates investor sentiment. What would you say are going to be the messages that you would be giving to the outside world later this year? It sounds like you're gearing up to larger harvest volumes for 2022, but what kind of messages can investors expect to listen to later this year from Atlantic?
Yes, so it's definitely true that being publicly listed and having to notify the outside world of everything that happens in the company basically has its pros and cons. And I think that there is no doubt that when we have negative events, such as a fire, such as an incident, which unfortunately has happened two times too much this year, then that is something that really overshadows all of the very important positive developments that happen day to day in our operations. We are now operating more than 12 independent systems, all stocked with fish, and we are day to day seeing more and more stable operations. To repeat an earlier point, what investors can expect is to really see biological KPIs on the new batches of salmon we have in our US facility that have actually had the conditions that we know as salmon farmers they need in order to deliver biologically. So what we will be doing over the next 12 months until we are in full steady state production in phase one is to give the investor community KPIs on how things are going, how are growth curves looking, how is biomass gain looking, to make it easier for people to track the positive developments. Because at the end of the day, the reality with salmon farming is that there is a long life cycle from egg to harvestable fish. So we're going to develop our reporting even further to make it easier to follow everything from all the positives we're seeing on the demand side, which we can probably talk about later, but also most importantly on the biological side, because the financial story in land-based is all about producing sufficient volumes to justify the high upfront costs. And we can fortunately see positive indicators of that biological performance a long time before the actual harvest of the fish happens.
Great, thank you. Once again, just a call for questions from the outside audience. We're still assembling those questions. I'm going to go back to Maggie. Just to take a bit of a step back, If you look at, I mean, your constituency look at oceans and aquaculture investments. How do they kind of look at the land-based segment versus other types of aquaculture investments?
Well, that's a great question. And on the production side, I think what makes land-based aquaculture particularly appealing to our members is the potential sustainability piece. And I don't want to say that the land-based aquaculture is inherently sustainable, because we know that it depends on your energy use and your water use and how you're actually producing. But you know, when we look at many of the negative impacts on that net pen aquaculture has, when we see that coupled with declining wild fish stocks, when we see that coupled with demand, the increased demand for protein for seafood, if you're able to do land-based aquaculture sustainably, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, but it's a fantastic potential solution. Demand for protein. And so for investors who are sustainably minded, it's particularly appealing. And I think that's what was driving and does continue to drive this interest. I think perhaps as offshore aquaculture becomes a bit more feasible on the technology and the capital side, then there might be some competition there. But truly, for investors who are sustainably minded, that's where land-based aquaculture comes into play. And I think, again, going back to the ancillary technology or some of the input piece, there are opportunities for investors to invest in that broader ecosystem and continue to play a role in pushing land-based aquaculture operations to being more sustainable as we work on these particular pieces.
That's great. Thank you. And again, we're just waiting for questions to be assembled. So I'll just keep asking away. It looks like there you go. I'll just ask one that I had on my mind for Eric, because I need to read these questions. So Eric, one thing, Nutreco and Skretting operates in the traditional aquaculture. Your clients very well. One of the things that really captures my attention is the fact that the conventional sea pen farmers and salmon operate RAS systems and RAS technology on a very large scale. Post-smolt seems to be the quickest way to increase salmon output in the world. I guess, how come do you think that sector hasn't taken the full step to getting actually investing in these projects? Nutreco has been quite bold and invested in some of them. We haven't seen the actual producers, the big producers, get involved. Do you, any theories on that one, or perhaps they're just waiting to see with technology?
Sure. Yeah, I don't think there's one single answer to that. I think there's many factors in play. If you look at the technology, so the RAS in post-smolt and post-smolt is a more proven technology at this stage, and that is to a large extent related to the fact that salmon, I guess in contrast to human beings, juvenile salmons are very easy to deal with. They're not as sensitive as they eventually become when they go into the grow-out phase. So it's a more has been and is a much more manageable part of the salmon life cycle in general. That's one reason. Another, I think, is there has been for decades a very, very strong ecosystem developed in, especially in Norway, but also the other major producing countries around conventional aquaculture, knowledge sharing, and developing that industry. So it's always easier to go for incremental gain or incremental improvements within the same ecosystem and production area that you already know. And then finally, I think a third a third reason is that many of the major companies, this is just a theory, but many of the major companies are listed companies. So theoretically, I think there's an argument that if one or more would to take a major leap into land-based salmon farming, as somehow cannibalizing existing assets and revenue streams. But that's just a theory.
Great. Okay, thanks very much. So we've now received a lot of questions, and I'm going to try and get through as many as I can. I was expecting a lot, and there they are. So, Carl, I'm going to start with you, and let's perhaps to get through lots of questions. Let's answer slightly briefer answers, but maybe we can get through as many as we can. One question is, you made a comment about small salmon in RAS not being viable. What would be too small for you? What do you think is the minimum amount of capacity for a viable project?
Well, that's a good question, and unfortunately there isn't one true answer to it, but what I can say is that out of the salmon land-based salmon farms in the world today, which most of them are in what I call the R&D size, 500 tons, maybe 1,000 tons of annual production, none of those are making money. So in other words, the answer is much higher than that. We know that our Danish facility was approximately at the size where you can make a decent profit if you're able to sell the fish at a premium. So that's a 2,400 ton facility. But even then, it's unless you have a price premium, it is difficult to be cost competitive with the conventional industry. So I think that the answer to the question is much closer to what we're doing in the US, where we are comfortable we will deliver a significant profit on phase one alone. And as you add more capacity, that's when you really see the true potential of unit economics. Our long-term ambition is to be the lowest cost producer of salmon delivered in the US. And we are very confident that we will get there in a not too distant future.
Okay, thank you. And a quick follow-on question. Some other companies report biomass kilo per cubic meter of growth. Is that something that Atlantic Sapphire does, and do you have a number for that?
Yes, we're actually the ones who invented that metric and called it the JEA index back in the day. So we do, and to give the answer, our phase one in the US, for example, when we were at full steady state production, which will be in the middle of next year, we'll have 0.47 in production per cubic meter per day. So that is what we're targeting. We're still ramping up the biomass, which means we don't have full utilization of the facility yet. So numbers are naturally lower, but that is where we're heading.
Perfect, thank you. Maggie, I'm gonna come back to you. So from the perspective of institutional investors, which particular ESG screens or metrics are they most concerned with in their evaluation of RAS opportunities?
Yeah, so I can speak broadly to what the investors I work with might look at or what I look at when doing an initial screen. But then when they get down into their own diligence, they all have specific metrics that they might look at. But at a high level, I would look at water usage. I would look at filtration and what's being done with effluent. I look at the energy source. And I look at the markets. I mean, I think that one of the major benefits of land-based is being close to major markets and being able to reduce the carbon footprint of the transportation. But if you're raising in the US and then shipping your product to Asia, that increases your carbon footprint and mitigates some of those sustainability claims. So I look at that as well. I look at feed, although I understand that this is an area where a lot of producers are looking to make some changes in the future to move away from wild caught based feed and fish meal and fish oil. But talk to them about their current plans and what they're thinking for the future. And then just broadly, having conversations about how they think about their supply chain and how they think about some of the sources of their inputs, either where they're at currently or plans if they're, for example, they're energy source might not be the cleanest right now, but plans in the future to try and shift that. So those are a couple of the metrics I look at. But again, it'll depend investor by investor what they're looking at once they're really getting into that deeper diligence.
Right, right. Have you just curiously, this is my own question, but have you seen many projects with renewable energy combined? And I guess those would be quite attractive, right?
Yes, not a lot, but I have seen one that was in the planning phase that does seek to combine renewable energy with production.
Great, thank you. Eric, I'm going to come to you. So for Nutreco, what's the minimum amount of revenue for a RAS project to consider for investments? And your kind of min-max numbers, I guess, for investing in any of these projects?
For the company?
I guess, yeah, for project value. So
several answers to that. So by revenue is obviously a factor of what you're able to sell at. We've taken the view that that salmon is a commodity species. I guess you could say that we have a quite conservative view when it comes to pricing. Any project that we look at would need to stand on its own two legs and be profitable selling at commodity pricing, so without any significant premium built into the price. That's not to say that we don't believe it's possible, but we don't move ahead with cases that are dependent on very high premium prices to generate a profit. So that's one. Second leg is volume. Coming back to Kalaistan's comment on what sort of a volume break even level for RAS. We don't know that either, but we have generated quite some proprietary data in all our due diligence, and I don't think it at least in our calcs doesn't require tens and tens of thousands of tons, but yes, they're the 500 ton farms, 1,000 tons farms, we also would be highly skeptical of in terms of generating healthy profit over time. We have there's one data point which is not great, which is Danish salmon in Denmark, whom I think were originally designed with design capacity of around 2,000 tons. And that's a design capacity, but arguably that's a previous generation RAS design and inefficient in terms of what the design capacity would be, and then generating around 1,000 tons a year, so half of what it was designed to. And that's barely break even, perhaps a little bit below that. If I'm going to give just a range, I would say you would need to be at least at the 2,500 tons and up,
right,
to have a viable business.
Great, and this person is asking about shrimp, and we did talk about shrimp in our previous conversation. What's your perspective on shrimp, Russ?
Yeah, good question. I'd like to distinguish there between, there's kind of two technology philosophies there. There's the clear water RAS shrimp philosophy that's, you could say, is more similar to land-based salmon farming, in that it's recirculating all the or most of the water, and the general aim is to filter out as much as possible of the waste and keep as clean of water as possible to maximize growth. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought is called bioflock RAS, which is an approach where nutrients in the water is conserved, and the wastewater in the water is subjected to a mechanism where it generates a lot of heterospiracy growth in the water, which the shrimp then ultimately feeds on as well, in addition to feed itself, which would lead to a lower environmental footprint because there's less discharge and also lower feed costs. The downside to that is that it could be potentially very difficult to manage. The water chemistry is very complex, and it requires a lot of, we have a German loan word in Norwegian called fingerspitzgefühl, that you really know what you're doing, and it's a certain factor of, let's call it intuition and learning by experience in order to run those systems successfully. And frankly, we don't know yet what the optimal approach is with a clear water or bioflock RAS.
Right. Great. Thank you. I'm going to move on. And Atlantic Sapphire questions. We've had a couple of questions, Carl, on, you know, when Atlantic Sapphire is likely to reach positive cash flow. Do you have a comment for that? I know it's sure. It depends on prices as well, which is crystal ball stuff. But
yeah, no, exactly. You can never guarantee anything, but I think we have a very good view on that. And if you think about the two parts of the equation, the price achievement, there we've seen consistently over the last year with harvest volumes in the US that we are achieving solid premium pricing. Those have been remarkably steady, so we also expect that going forward. Then it comes down to the other part, which is the cost per kilo, which you need in order to be profitable, and that one is 100% connected to the total volumes you're producing, because this is a fixed cost business. The only true variable cost is your feed. So we will be profitable as soon as we get into steady state production, which is going to be in the middle of next year. So that's when you can also expect to see a positive EBITDA and a positive cash flow from our US phase one standalone.
Right. And just to add my own question to that, I think the Denmark facility, there have been incidents over the years, but you have actually achieved steady state. And I remember Johan telling me about this on the call, but you've had quite a few quarters of steady state production, right? Does that give you an indication that the same can be achieved in Miami? And I guess in an improved facility, because as Eric said, the technology, each generation of technology is better than the last.
Absolutely. So Denmark was, when it's been in steady state, has shown us that we can get costs down to the fixed costs down to a very manageable level, so that as long as we're producing close to the nameplate capacity that farm had and selling the fish at the decent prices, then that can be a profitable business. And in the US, it's even easier to reach that profitable level because of the price premium that you're achieving in the US market. So Denmark has definitely proven that point, and it's been an important proof of concept for us to do this large scale in the US, to really see those key cost elements in action, and then it's much easier for us to execute here in the US, knowing that what success will look like.
Great, thank you, Maggie. I'm going to ask you a question about the US aquaculture. A year or two ago, there was a unanimous decision by both parties in the US to push forward the aquaculture bill to encourage investments. And however, we've seen some difficulties with companies getting licensing. And in Maine, there's one notable case. Do you think we're going to see more of that? I mean, considering that land-based is, as you say, is such a sustainable way of producing protein, what do you make of the kind of civil opposition, and how do you think that will evolve going forward?
Yeah, we do talk a fair amount about the regulatory process, and I think quite often when I have conversations, not only the regulatory process, but I think a key part of that social license comes into play as well, and that's certainly what you're talking about with what we're seeing with some of the litigation. I don't want to speak to any specific case, but certainly there are concerns from communities about the impact on their economic viability, on the impact of perhaps effluent discharge on their waterways and their livelihoods. And so from what I've seen, it seems like it's critical to be able to come in and demonstrate, you know, any mitigation plans that are in place to be able to resolve some of these concerns. Certainly not saying that any companies or companies that are facing litigation are not doing that. I know in some communities it's an uphill battle, but I think there's a lot of interests at play here, and whether that's from the environmental NGO community, whether that is from the fishing community, who have their own interests. And so I think that land-based aquaculture will have to be able to continue to demonstrate publicly, you know, what it can do economically for communities, what it can do, you know, how it's able to raise fish sustainably and humanely in order to combat some of this negative sentiment that is shared out. And you know, you have that, and then you also have, you know, things like Seaspiracy, and I believe that there's another film that's coming out now that's, you know, trying to push people away from seafood, put people away from seafood on a whole. So there's a lot to combat here. And so I think that the land-based industry will just have to continue to be clear on its potential and what it can and is doing, and be transparent on that.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. Eric, I'm going to come back to you. We have a question from somebody based in Asia on asking a pretty similar question about what we were just talking about, which is stocking density and what is profitable. But in this case with Barramundi, is this a species? This is quite an interesting species because I think people are talking about it could become the next salmon. Not sure if that's a little bit hyped, but have you seen land-based projects in that space? And if not, I mean, are there any other species you think could really take off in land-based?
I've not personally seen any land-based Barramundi projects. We do think it's a species with a potential in general, also for conventional aquaculture. There's a company that recently raised a significant amount of equity for conventional aquaculture of Barramundi in Southeast Asia. As to the biological performance of Barramundi in RAS, I'm unfortunately not an expert on that species, so I wouldn't be able to tell, unfortunately.
Yeah, but are there any other species that you think in land-based, you know, gosh, that could really take off?
Yes and no. I mean, there's I think there's a reasonable argument that yellowtail is a suitable fish for land-based farming. It's a very robust species. It's exceptionally high growth compared to salmon, but it's not as a commoditized species as salmon is. So there are limits to how many companies and how much growth you can achieve in. So for us to be, if we were to be convinced of to invest in a company focusing on, for example, yellowtail, we would take a much more closer look at your sales strategy, value across in to markets where that fish could succeed, etc. But do I think there will be a new salmon? No.
Good answer, thank you. So Carl, I'm going to come back to you. We have, well, there's one comment, it's not a question. Eminent expert said in 2016 that it would be impossible to run a massive RAS salmon farm in southern Florida. Everything is impossible until someone is doing it. So,
true statement.
Yes. Another question we have is, you know, before that last week, Atlantic Sapphire was talking about the robustness of steelhead in a RAS facility. And I think the plan was to do that in Denmark. Does that still figure somewhere in Atlantic Sapphire's plans?
The Trout test and trial project unfortunately ended the Trout being at the wrong place at the wrong time. But I think what we saw from those months of testing was promising. And there was nothing that we saw of data that convinced us the trout is not a potentially interesting species for RAS farming in the future. It's not priority for us. Our priority is and has always been farming Atlantic salmon. But if you look long term, it could potentially be a secondary route. There is a lot of advantages with the trout, just like with, for example, the yellowtail. It's more robust than the salmon, which is an advantage in RAS. And maybe most importantly, it's a species that grows fast, which allows you to get a higher turnover of your biomass and hence also lower cost per kilo. So it's something that is not off the table for us, but I wouldn't call it a strategic priority by any means at this point.
Okay, no, thank you for that. Just Maggie, I'm going to ask you about the whole issue of land-based pricing over conventional products. And I think, you know, because the reason I ask this to you is because when in all of these ROI models, it premium pricing is baked into the projects. What do your investors make of that, and what do they, how do they approach that topic when looking at an MPV model and it's based on a premium of X value over the conventional price? Hello, is there a technical issue?
Oh, it's
yeah, something's going on. Am I silent? Can anybody hear me?
We can hear you, Matt.
Yes,
I can hear you.
Okay, yeah. But maybe not the question.
If you asked me a question, I actually lost my internet connection. I just got back on, I didn't hear it. Right. Could you repeat the question?
Not a problem. Okay, good. So the question is, most of these projects, when you look at the MPV model, you see a premium price that's baked into that MPV model. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that premium pricing? How do they, when they assess a project, how do they look at that aspect of the, you know, the project criteria?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really depends on the species that you're talking about. And I think it depends on, So often you would do a sensitivity analysis of looking at not only the premium pricing that the company's putting forward and saying that they can get, but also looking at if you were to get lower price and not be able to get the prices that they'd like, you know, what does that look like in terms of profitability and returns? And so certainly you'd want to make sure that even if you're not able to get this premium price, that, you know, that you're able to still get the return that you want. And so modeling that out is important. And also, you know, looking at and truly understanding what is the market size that has a willingness to pay at that size. And I saw a question come in about smaller, you know, more cottage projects that do sell at a higher price. And not to get ahead of you, Matt, but you know, there's lots of food companies that I see, whether it's, you know, RAS or whether it's a packaged good product that are selling at a really high price and they're having a lot of success. But it's a really small market. Maybe they're selling only to people in California right now who will pay more for sustainability, but in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, they're not going to get that. So being able to do that sensitivity analysis and make sure that you can still get the returns that you're looking for at those lower prices in case that pricing doesn't really hold out when you expand the project is really critical. But to give a specific price that they're looking for, you know, I can't do that because it really depends on the project, on the species, and so on, and also on the investor themselves and the return they're looking for.
Perfect. Eric, just a quick, you know, a quick message to the audience. We have a lot of questions. We're just extending by a few minutes, but we'll finish at 10 minutes past the hour. So we've got 8 minutes left, and that's our lot. So, Eric, as now NewTracker has done several projects, and you look at the cost breakdown and that MPV model, how do you look at the breakdown of costs in a RAS project? And maybe what have been your learnings over time as you've done the due diligence on several projects now?
I mean, Kurdistan is right that by far the biggest cost is a feed, which I've seen ranges from between 40 to 60% per kilo produced. 40 to 60% of that cost would be attributable to the feed. So that is, it's obviously something you can't get around. The fish needs to eat and then eat optimal feed developed for specifically for RAS, which I know that Skretting is spending a very significant proportion of its research activities on. Apart from that is there is a bit more sensitivity to energy prices, much more than so RAS would be more lower, less resilient to spikes in that if there is no direct energy connection to the RAS site. Then, apart from that, of course, you have your labor and your farm management, and we actually do spend quite a bit of our attention in that area as well, because I think down the line, when RASCO has been more matured, it allows for greater automation, a greater use of digital farming to drive production decisions and optimally manage your biomass, which would allow lower labor costs. I think at where the where we currently are in the development cycle, I wouldn't bet on the automation potential utilized for some years yet, but there is potential there to reduce labor's share of the cost breakdown.
Perfect. And actually, that's a great segue into the next question. There was a question about the constraints, which we've been constantly told about in the industry, of skilled personnel with expertise. And I think, Carl, I'm going to ask you this question because I know that the Atlantic Sapphire alluded to this in the Q2 results, but just perhaps give us a sense of this difficulty, the bottleneck of skilled people to run these facilities, and how do you think that will improve in the future or will continue to be a constraint?
I think definitely the answer is that will be a constraint. So Atlantic Sapphire spent 10 years building up its own team that has not only brought some of the smartest brains from the RAS industry to our company, but also built up in-house competency with many years of operating multiple independent systems. And that is truly something we think is unique about Atlantic Sapphire, that we have so much brain power, so much knowledge in one place, because there are very few people in the industry that really know how to design and how to operate advanced system like a RAS system. And the issue is that not only are there new land-based projects out there that will require those people, but also you have strong demand from the incumbent industry that is building land-based facilities. They're, as a matter of fact, the biggest investor in land-based, with the giant investments being made in post-smolt. So definitely it's going to be a very scarce resource, and one that will put the limitation on supply growth for the next 10 years. I think it's going to take a lot of time to develop more people, because this is not easy. This is something that really requires a lot of experience. And in our opinion, what we're doing is developing our Bluehouse technology into being much more of a process industry that allows for automation, that allows for much less room for human errors, and much more processes that would be similar to what you see in an oil refinery. So I think that is where we're heading to really create the salmon farming of the future.
Yeah, no, perfect. And I'm going to add my own question very quickly. This is just say no if you don't want to answer this question. But when you what we've seen is that you get often these projects are run by people who run smolt facilities for conventional salmon farmers, and they're appointed from Chile, where I'm sat, or from Norway, and that's your chief technician. How many groups out there do you think can realistically make a facility work without some pretty serious issues that have the in-house skill to make this work?
Well, it's very hard to give a number to that, but I think reading between the line on your question, you're inferring the right thing, that there is very few people who can do that. And to take it one step further, what we've seen, having operated full grow-out systems for multiple years, is that not all the conventional industry wisdom from freshwater RAS is transferable to what we're doing. So I would even question if some of the smartest minds from the smolt industry are able to successfully farm salmon all the way to harvestable size, because that is, in fact, very different.
Perfect. Where are we at on time? Gosh, 1 minute. We've run out of time. Quick fire last question to everybody. Do you think there are any known unknowns or unknown unknowns out there that could change this debate in a year or 5 years? Maggie, anything that people are not talking about right now that could change this entire scenario for land-based?
Maggie's on mute.
Ah.
I am on mute, but I guess I just bought myself another few seconds to think about that, because that's a tough question. But I think if offshore aquaculture becomes more competitive, I think that might shift some capital away from land-based to offshore aquaculture. So I'd want to keep an eye on, and I do keep an eye on those developments and the feasibility of it.
Thank you. Same question to you, Eric.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, no worries. Any known unknowns or unknown unknowns, things that might change the whole debate on RAS land-based farm?
I think where we're presently at will open up an opportunity for other pockets of capital to take a step into this scene. For example, maybe because of this reliance so far on Nordic capital markets, we've not really seen a huge amount of family office capital gone into this sector. But we know there are, take US, for example, Atlantic Sapphire and others, US has the greatest concentration of family offices in the world. Many of them are highly devoted to sustainability and ESG. And I cannot see any reason for those types of investors to not go into this space as well.
Perfect. Thank you. And finally, Carl, same question to you, and we'll wrap it up.
I think that we as a company, we are 100% sure that land-based salmon farming will succeed and it will become financially viable. And we're just months away from seeing that happen, which is very exciting. That being said, we're also quite sure that it's going to take a long time before land-based salmon farming is a real supply contributor to the global volumes. We think that in the next 5 years, we will be farming 75% of all global land-based salmon farming volumes. And we think that within the next 10 years, there won't be a lot of production all in all and a lot of harvest volumes. But that being said, and food for thought is what can happen 10 to 20 to 30 years from now, then we think that the potential is enormous, and it's going to be very interesting to follow the industry over the next two decades.
Perfect. I'd like
to end with a story, Matt, if we have some time.
Go for it.
On that, because we talk a lot about, of course, we're looking ahead and 30, 40 years into the future, but this whole discussion reminds me of a story I've heard internally, and this is a true story that back in 1969, Skretting started out its first commercial trials with pelletized feed for what was then a trout farming operation. And this was back in the day when the cages were slightly less complex than they are today, made of wood and metal grids. And the result of that trial was a 98% mortality rate using pelletized feed. And that was obviously the feed formulations were a bit different then. That was considered a tremendous success because 2% of the fish survived, which proved that it was possible to feed fish with something else than live feed, which was the standard of the day, and that was not sustainable in the long run. But any investor back then, looking at that trial, we would not ever blame that investor for walking away. And that investor would have missed out on an industry that has grown from essentially nothing to a multi-billion dollar industry. So I think it's useful to look at what has happened in the past as well and try to extrapolate that into the future.
Yeah, it's a great point, Eric, and you look at the Chile in the 1970s and it turned from nothing into the second biggest economic activity in the entire country, in where I'm sat right now, and provided employment to the south of the country that didn't have any principal industry. It's a great point. Thank you for sharing that. And so that's all we got time for. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Panaferd AX, Exit and Clean, InnovaSea, and Skretting. And I'd like to say a big thank you to our panelists. There's great answers, and we've had some encouraging feedback. So thank you, Maggie, Eric, and Carl. I thought you did a great job on this webinar, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for inviting us.
I look forward to seeing you all now that industry events are starting to happen in person again, and that's a good thing. So look forward to catching up with you all soon.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt.
Bye. Thank you.